Good morning and welcome to this special session of the Court of Appeals to hear the Barron Estate appeal. I know we have experienced counsel here. Does any of you have any questions concerning our customary procedures? For purposes of our guests, if any of you has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the lawyers are not interrupted during their argument? This is a somewhat unusual case for many reasons. We've sent out an order setting forth the times and the order of argument. That itself strains our resources to keep track of. We would implore you to stay within your time limits, follow the order of argument set forth in the order, and on that basis, we're ready to proceed.
May please the court and all counsel present. I'm Blaine Myrie, counsel for David Barron in this appeal. And in my time, I'd like to address three issues: the moratorium interest issue, the corporate governance scheme, and the PR's compensation. On the moratorium interest issue, the probate court awarded moratorium interest of $24.5 million on Miriam Barron's elective share. And she did so, the court did so, without statutory authorization. The probate code creates a comprehensive statutory scheme for administering estates, and part of that comprehensive statutory scheme is the elective share provision, CRS 1511-201. That provision entitled Miriam Barron to elect against the will and to receive an elective share amount of one half the value of the augmented estate, and that is as of the date of death. The statute is clear. It is an elective share amount. It is a sum certain. No provision of the probate code grants authority to award interest or to make an equitable adjustment to that amount. In fact, in the 2008 amendments to the Uniform Probate Code does have a provision which, if adopted in Colorado, would treat the elective share as a pecuniary devise, which then would be entitled to interest as provided under CRS 1512-904. But the Colorado legislature has not adopted that provision, despite adopting other provisions of the 2008 UPC amendments. So unless and until the Colorado legislature adopts an interest provision, either as suggested by the commissioners of the UPC or some other provision that would grant the right to interest, there is no right to interest in this case.
In the legislative history or any of the commentary that's arisen in the Colorado lawyer that the legislature even considered the UPC amendment to which you referred?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any legislative history. I confess I have not listened to the tapes. But
Mr. Myrie, Judge Stewart relied on the statute that says that principles of equity still apply under the code. And under what circumstances would that statute apply if not these?
Well, Your Honor, that provision, 1510-103, provides that unless displaced by particular provisions of this code, the principles of law and equity supplement its provisions. It's a simple provision that recognizes that probate courts or a district court sitting in probate has equitable power to do ordinary things in equity. That means it can have findings that issues are subject to estoppel or waiver or things like that. But it does not give a grant to alter the elective share scheme. And that's where the fault lies with reliance on that statute. The elective share provision is addressed fully in the probate code. It identifies what the electing spouse gets. It does not provide for an interest award, despite the fact that the probate code has an interest provision elsewhere. The elective share, for whatever reason, does not share in interest. Now, that was a change from the previous statute. The pre-1995 statute was a fractional share, which entitled the electing spouse to take a share of the estate. And in that statutory scheme would in fact be entitled to receive the appreciation of the estate through that fractional share. But under the elective share scheme now, it is a sum certain, and it is not something that it lends itself to an award of interest in the absence of a statute.
But the prior statute specifically and expressly say that you get interest on the fractional share, or is that court-made law?
Well, Your Honor, that's more a function of the way the statute worked. It was a fractional share of the augmented estate. So it was a fraction, whether one half or less than one half, of the estate the augmented estate in its entirety. It was not a pecuniary sum certain amount. So that, in and of itself, just the way the statute worked, would allow for the spouse who elected to, as part of the fractional share, either receive the benefits or the detriments of rise or fall of estate value.
But I take it the statute didn't expressly address, the prior statute didn't expressly address the interest.
No, it did not. No.
Thank you.
The other thing that is relied on is the Estate of Smith case, and that's what the court initially referred to. But I think Estate of Smith is distinguishable on several grounds. First of all, that was decided at a time when the statute was the fractional share statute that Judge Loeb had just asked about. So it's distinguishable on that basis. In addition, the parties in Smith did not dispute the award of interest. There was no fight, so to speak, over whether there was authority to award the interest. It was just a question of when the interest should be awarded. In addition, the FRICO case, which we cite in our brief, the farmers' irrigation case, specifically says that now in Colorado, moratory interest is a creature of statute, and without a statutory basis, there is no award for moratory interest. Here, there is no statutory basis. Nothing that the court relied on. The court relied on pure equitable power. There is no pure equitable power to do what the court did here, which was to alter the amount that Mrs. Barron was to receive under the elective share. In fact, double it.
Mr. Myers, I understand your position then. The court did not have authority to provide any increase in the amount awarded to Mrs. Barron, whether it was characterized as moratory interest, an equitable adjustment, or any other term that might have been used. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The statute defines it, and that's the statute defines it, and until there's a change in the statute to allow for it, there is no additional award that can be made, regardless of how it's dressed up. I know Mr. Brigg is going to address moratorium interest as well, so I'd like to move on to the corporate governance issue. Under the will, the residual beneficiaries, the seven children, are each entitled to 1/7 of Bear Energy. The corporate governance scheme that was put into place here distributes shares unequally. It gives shares of unequal value to the two, quote, factions. The four sons receive a single share with a single voting right. They receive 1,000 shares each that has one vote per share, whereas the what we call the CJD, the other three children, receive 1,000 shares each, but each share bears 1 1/3 vote per share. Now, the reason that that was done is set forth in the corporate governance plan. But the result of it is that shares of unequal value are proposed to be distributed, and the shares have not yet been distributed.
Was probate court presented with any evidence of the practical consequence on the shares value of the difference in voting rights?
She was presented arguments on what the effect would be, and I think the effect is clear and from the pleadings that the parties filed that it could result in a shareholder deadlock on issues.
Well, my question was perhaps poorly framed. Let me try it again. Was the probate court presented with any expert testimony that the shares in the Class A shares are worth X and the Class B shares are worth Y, and the difference between X and Y is a function of the voting rights.
Your Honor, I do not believe that was the case, and I'm not sure that that was really taken up at the September 2010 hearing. That was mostly focused on the compensation of the personal representative. So to answer your question, I don't believe there was, but I think it's just simple common sense that if I want to buy a share of stock, I want the share that has the most voting rights. And I think that is the problem here and why there's an inequality. And because of that inequality, this plan of distribution is not consistent with what the will it requires.
But when you use the term value with respect to this issue, are you defining that as fair market value?
Your Honor, I think fair market value could be one definition. I know the statutes that referred to in the case that cited by the personal representative talk about fair value and distinguish that from fair market value. But I think fair market value, in the absence of another definition, is probably the most appropriate definition. And I would like to address now the personal representative's compensation and then reserve a few minutes for rebuttal. The personal representative received $17 million in total compensation. Of that, he received about $5.5 million throughout the years of the estate proceedings, and then subsequently requested an additional $10.25 million in additional compensation along with a stipend of $1.5 million per year until he was discharged, which occurred in April of 2011.
Is there any expert report at level?
There was evidence presented that the challenged the compensation level. And I think it's important as well to look at what the actual compensation report does vis-a-vis the Painter case. Because the compensation report, which was prepared by an expert in executive compensation, and the expert admitted he had no basis for to opine about how the estate was valued or why it appreciated. So the expert relied on figures given to him by the personal representative.
Again, my question, though, is a little narrower. Mm-hmm. Did any of the parties challenging the PR's compensation present expert testimony that that level of compensation was not reasonable in light of what the PR had done for the last four?
Your Honor, my understanding is they did, but off the top of my head, I cannot recall exactly the testimony. As you can imagine, this record gets a bit overwhelming at times. But I think my argument more addresses the problem with the expert report that was relied on, because that is the evidence that the court took into consideration. And on that front, the report itself relies on these valuations. And then in determining the estate component, it looked at how institutional fiduciaries would have managed this estate and what they would have charged. And what they would have charged is a percent of the assets. And the problem with doing that here is that is what Painter says you can't do. You can't rely on a percent of the valuation as the basis. You need to look at the services rendered. Now, where that's particularly problematic here is because the increase in the value of the estate, as other evidence in the record shows, is largely the product of appreciation of the assets, which is related to the rise in oil price. There is a report by Leslie Patton that was filed July 10th, 2009, in connection with determining the moratorium interest award, in which the estate was valued as of March 1st, 2000, and as December 31st, 2007. And the difference in value was about $100 million. So in that seven-year period, there was about $100 million in appreciation. And Mr. Patton attributed that largely to the rise in oil price. Page 15 of that report that I mentioned, Mr. Patton says the asset appreciation, which is about 54% due to asset appreciation, and the asset appreciation was based in the change in the oil price in that seven-year period where there was a rise of about $70 a barrel.
Now, assuming that exactly what is it that you would propose we do?
It would have to be remanded for further proceedings, Your Honor, to address more specifically the services rendered and the compensation for such services without resort to just a value-based approach. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Morning. My name is Chuck Briga, number 2731. I represent the three sons of Mr. Barron, first wife, and we'll refer to them as the three sons, or Jonathan, Zev, and Daniel. I would like to talk about the moratorium interest issue, the issue of partial settlement, and the corporate governance. Now, I probably won't cover much of those in here, although we still reserve our right on rebuttal if somebody brings it up in there, please. What we're asking you to do in moratorium interest is on a de novo basis, which we believe this is the standard on, to find reversible error in this matter, that there cannot be any interest awarded on this elective share, to send it back to the court to reallocate the residual estate and the contribution amounts that fall into that category. The court will know that because those all came in the event that it is reversed in this way. Now, there is no case in Colorado that deals with the issue you're talking about with this specific statute. When the law was changed in 1994 on the probate code and changed from a fractional share to a pecuniary amount, there has been no case that then goes up on those issues that is of assistance to you on this particular provision or statute. Right? What we have here is a difference when the legislature changed this. What did they change? A fractional share was 50% of the probate, an augmented probate estate, just like the elective share is. However, it goes up and down as the value of the estate goes up and down. So you get 50%, but if the state goes up as this one did, you would have gotten a higher amount. If it had gone down, they would have gotten a lesser amount until the time when it was paid out. That's what the case law says. In an elective share, which was affirmatively changed by the legislature, it is 50% of the augmented estate, period. Now, the legislature provided for interest in certain provisions of the probate code, and that provision which it has is the devisee provision, special devisee award in the will, and there they have interest provided for at the statutory rate after 1 year if it hasn't been paid. But they have none in the statute relating to this. Now, we don't believe the statute on moratorium interest could be used in any rate because the statute on moratorium interest is no longer equitable but is codified. The judge talked about it as though she had an equitable right to use moratorium interest, even though it is now codified by law, is no longer a subject of equity under the moratorium interest statute in Colorado. Here's what she was trying to do. And this is why, in my opinion, this is such a serious issue for this court. She, in her order, used moratorium interest from March of 2003, when she said we're going to award a moratorium interest, even though in 1999 she said that was she could not award interest because the legislature hadn't provided for. But she reserved the right for moratory interest in that same order. So in 03, after we had the long trial of 13 days, to both which was challenging by Mrs. Burham, $9 million worth of things that she called loans to the sons who were in business with their father forever and ever. In her amended petition for the allocation, she charged that the estate really wasn't $73 million. It should have been $82 million because the businesses with the sons and the father were all gifts and they should have been included in the estate and therefore deprived the children of that much of a share of that estate.
Edgar, let me
just want
to make one thing clear. I assume the corollary of your argument is that under the current statute, if the market had tanked and the value of the estate had gone down, the estate couldn't go back and try to seek money back from the elected share.
Absolutely not. She stays at that amount, 50% of the augmented estate as of the date of death. In that case, it was $31 million was her elective share. And then with subtractions from that for things she already had, she was to be paid out of the state then $26 million, 25, 9, some numbers, but $26 million. And what the judge did as the judge went along in this moratory interest, she repeated it in 05, she repeated it in 06, she repeated it in 07 in order to moratory interest until the date of distribution of this estate. Until the date of distribution created an enormous problem for everybody. How are you going to value the estate again on the date of distribution when we didn't know when that date was going to be? But that's what she said until in 2007 she told the PR, get me the dates, submit to me the dates that you think we should determine this moratory interest. He then, in June of 07, sent her back a proposal that the moratory interest should run from May 1st of 2000 to December 31st of 2007, and she said okay, but it took her a year before she answered his proposal. She didn't answer back with an order agreeing to that until August of 2008, over a year after that proposal was made. So now the parties were then put in the dilemma of re-evaluating the state from the year 2000 for the first end of the moratory interest and December 31st of 07 for the back end. And in that period of time, as has been stated here, Mr. Patton found that the value of the estate had gone up about $100 million. Over 50% of that was unrealized gains from the increase of oil. That then was adopted by the court, that valuation. It was called an investment rate of return, which when divided over the 7 years meant that it had gone up 17.46% per year. The court then told Mr. Goodyear, who's the PR, what was her unpaid balance of her elective share as of May of 2000? And the unpaid balance of the $26 million was $10,350,000. So here's the way this was calculated. We start out with $10,350,000. And she gets 17.46% compounded monthly every month for the next 7 years. That amount came out to be $24,501,457 that was added on to her estate. Now, they call it pecuniary interest for a long time, but this is what she says in her order. I'm now going to call this equitable interest. It's not a punitive award. It's not that. I've not said these are good people, that they're bad people. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. It's not that. This is in order of July of 09, after the hearing. I was trying to make an adjustment that I thought was reflective of my responsibility to do equity in an estate. She had said earlier the estate had gone up so much in value that she thought she deserved some of
that. Baker, let me ask you a real practical question.
You betcha.
If this panel were to agree with your position on the validity of the equitable adjustment, what does our order look like? What does the trial court, the probate court, do when it goes back? What are you asking us to do?
On this issue.
If we were to agree with you on the law, what happens?
Then I suggest it goes back to the court and you tell the court to undo the $26 million, recalculate the estate by putting it back in the general funds of the estate, and then redistribute it to the heirs based on their percentage share. And that's what would happen in that regard. Now, I think is it yellow two? How much time is it?
About 4 minutes left, Mr.
Okay,
Baker.
Good. Thank you. So what we have here, and by the way, there was no hearing. There was no hearing granted by the court on the corporate governance. In the other question that was asked about, was there an expert call on the compensation issue? There was not. All right. So one of the things, if you look at this, the elective share code provides every element of the elective share. There are four different categories that it describes in there, in itself. So none of these other cases apply because the court specifically provides all four of the categories of where she can get it, where it comes from, and as you probably know, she ended up getting $450,000 back from the $1 million our sons got on contribution that she took back. She didn't go after her own children for that, but she got it back from all the four sons of the original father. The law is under Holdridge, and I think this is a pretty important case, and probably you all know this law anyway. It says where a statutory scheme provides for a remedy, in this case, that the devisees have interest on theirs, but not under another provision does it provide for that relief. And under our elective share, provide for no interest, in spite of it, in the same statute has it for another group. It must be presumed that the statute does not authorize the use of a remedy under that section to change it. The law is what it is, and they presume to have done what they intended to do, the legislature, in that regard. Now, another reason that you can't have a wrongful moratorium interest but in this case is because she never found any fault anywhere. And the moratorium interest statute, even the codified statute, says wrongfully withheld. And you will look at the Goodyear case and a couple of the other cases I cited in there, but that case says it has to be deprived of something she was otherwise entitled to.
Mr. Braga,
yes, sir.
Since Judge Stewart changed the nomenclature from moratory interest to equitable adjustment, would that make any difference in terms of your argument about wrongful withholding being required as a finding?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I've always thought this wasn't really interesting at all. The way she did this was she determined the investment rate of return over 7 years of this estate, which was $100 million. Then she gave her pro rata share of that $100 million increase in value through 17.46%, A year for 7 years.
If it wasn't interest at all, then why wouldn't the probate court have any authority to exercise its equitable powers to increase the elective share?
What she has done then is changed this back to a fractional share, because now she's getting an increase in the value of the estate by $26 million, which she cannot do under the pecuniary statute that's in effect since 1995.
Well, let me press you on that. Mr. Myrie said that he didn't think that there could be any increase at all. And I understand what you're saying. I think that you can't go and create a fractional interest, but suppose the interest that the probate court had awarded was not a fractional interest, but say, just as an example, $2 million. Do you still think that would have been impermissible?
Absolutely. The statute is clear that it's 50% of the augmented estate in that, and you can't modify that by doing what she did. You don't think she would have modified it down, do you, if it had gone down? Nobody would have said she could have moved it down. There's no reason to think then she could have moved it up. Do I have any time, or do you know?
Sir, you're...
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alan Sweetbaum, and I represent three of the children, Joshua Barron, Dina Grossman, and the estate of Cheryl Feldberger. Let me start, Your Honors, by acknowledging that by far, at least in terms of dollars, the biggest issue here deals with the moratorium interest, which we've obviously just heard to counsel eloquently speak on. On that issue, however, let me make it clear, if it's not already made clear in our briefs, that we do not take a position one way or the other regarding whether the court had the authority to issue moratory interest or an equitable adjustment, whatever it's called. We have not made any argument about that in our briefs. Instead, we focused on what I guess I would describe as some ancillary issues. There were three issues that we raised in our opening brief, our cross appeal, and there were three rebuttal issues. Clearly, I'm not going to have time to get through all six of those issues. So, what I guess I'd like to do is focus on the issues, what I would describe as the three issues in our cross appeal, and then just keep going until I'm out of time. Hopefully, I'll have an opportunity to reserve a little bit of time for rebuttal to deal with the rebuttal issues. So, let me start with the issue regarding what we call the Moyer leases. They are referred to in our briefs as the disputed leases. Specifically, we are talking about two oil and gas leases which are located in Weld County. Sometimes they're also referred to as the Moyer A and B leases. Your Honor, I think the evidence about how those leases were conveyed to my clients is clear. In September of 1992, Sheldon Barron, the decedent, conveyed all of his right, title, and interest in those two leases, the Moyer A and B leases, to a limited partnership known as CJD, which is a limited partnership in which my three clients have or own 99% interest. The conveyance was done pursuant to a document which was entitled Conveyance and Assignment. It was signed, it was witnessed, it was notarized, and it was recorded with the clerk and recorder of Weld County on September 14, 1992. Your Honors, it's our position that document is clear and it's unambiguous, at least from my review, not only of the briefs that were filed on appeal in this case, but from my attempting to get through the extensive record at the trial court level. I cannot find any evidence where anybody has challenged that document is anything other than clear and unambiguous. What it does, it's obvious it's in the record, we cite to it in our brief, it describes the leases in an exhibit, specifically Exhibit A to the lease, and then it goes on to state that what is being conveyed is without limitation all other rights, titles, and interests of whatever kind or character of grantor in and to the oil, gas, and the minerals.
Mr. Sweetbaum, if that conveyance is as clear as you are telling us, why then did Judge Stewart ask Mr. Goodyear to determine what Mr. Barron's intent was with regard to that conveyance?
And that's I'm just going to get to that. That is obviously one of the issues, and we think that was error. What happened was Judge Stewart entered an order that it was the personal responsibilities, the PR's responsibility to make a determination about what the decedent's intent was. I think implicit, Your Honor, in that order was that there first had to be a determination that this document was something other than being clear and unambiguous. That, of course, is the whole concept of what the parole evidence rule is. Under the parole evidence rule, you first have to look within the four corners of the document to make a legal determination about whether or not there is any ambiguity. If there's not an ambiguity, it is interpreted, it is enforced as written. So I think it's either, with respect to your specific question, it's either that it was implicit in the court's order that there first had to be a determination that there was ambiguity, and if that's not what Judge Stewart meant, I think that was an error of law that I think Your Honor's review de novo.
Did the four sons argue that the conveyance document was ambiguous?
Well, first of all, on appeal, the only parties to challenge this specific issue was Bob Goodyear. I'm sitting on the same side of the table as him. Maybe that's a mistake. And David, the three sons did not challenge that issue in any of their briefs. And as a result, it's our position that they've waived the right to object to it now. At the trial court level, I believe you're asking, did they challenge whether or not it was an ambiguous document? I don't think that issue was ever raised except in our trial brief, which was submitted to the court, where we made the argument that it was clear and unambiguous. And of course, that argument was rejected.
Does the document, in your view, unambiguously state that this transfer was a loan or a gift?
It doesn't state one way or the other.
Isn't that the issue?
I don't think it is. The issue came down or comes down, and I think what the trial court had to decide and what Your Honors have to decide is whether or not it's a conveyance of a working interest or a royalty interest or both. And what that document called conveyance and assignment specifically does is it specifically states that it's a conveyance of all right, title, and interest, making no distinction whatsoever. And I think and what the personal representative did was say, no, it did not include the working interests. And the basis, at least the only basis that I can tell from why the personal representative made that determination, was because there had been working interest payments to another company that had been formed called Masliak. And Masliak is a company that's owned 12% by the four sons, 87% by the estate, and 1% by Bear Energy. So what had happened, and again, there's very little evidence of this at all, because this is in some proposed findings that were adopted by the court, and then it was ultimately in the proposed distribution by the personal representative. But it appears that the only basis upon which the personal representative decided that it was the intent of the decedent not to convey the working interest, despite the clear and unambiguous language in this document, is the fact that the working interest payments had been paid to this entity called Masliak. And in fact, it's our contention that you can't even, first of all, my clients didn't even know about that, so I don't think that can be really that relevant, but you can't reach the issue of the decedent's intent until you determine that there is some ambiguity in the conveyance and assignment document. A lot of this, if not all of it, Your Honors, really comes down to the issue of the parole evidence rule and the interpretation and the application of the parole evidence rule. I think it was simply done backwards here. What happened was the court entered the order, as Judge Taubman indicated. It's saying the PR has to determine intent. The PR looked, I think, at this issue of the payments, the working interest payments being made to Masliak, and determined that was the intent, and basically then determined that despite this conveyance and assignment that the working interest in the Moyer A and B leases weren't intended to go to my client, and they offset the value of the Moyer A and B leases against the distribution to my client's share of the estate. By the way, that was about $585,000. Essentially, what was happening was that my client is being asked to pay for an asset twice, an asset they had already paid for. Now, with respect to what should happen to this issue, I believe this also has to be remanded, Your Honor, back to the trial, back to the probate court, because what I think the evidence also establishes pretty clearly is that from the date of the decedent's death until the date that the valuation of the Moyer A and B leases was made, which was in 2009, all of those working interest payments had already been paid to Mutz Liok. And that was about another $780,000. So we're not really just talking about a $580,000 issue. We're talking about an issue of $1.2 million, which I understand may pale in comparison to what we're looking at when we look at the moratory interest issue, but it's still serious money. I think it was Senator Proxmire who said a million here, a million there, and pretty much you're talking about real money. These are dollars, although relatively speaking, it's not the same as the moratory interest issue. So, Your Honor, we believe that the issue, although it may be a mixed question of law and fact with respect to how you review this, I think with respect to the parole evidence rule, that is a de novo issue, and that is an issue I think that was simply a mistake at the probate court level, and it was just simply done wrong, thereby making my clients essentially have to pay for an asset of the estate that they already paid for. I have 4.5 minutes, so I'd like to reserve a little bit of time. Let me move on to the equitable adjustment issue, or the moratory interest issue. Again, let me just reiterate, we don't take a position regarding Mrs. Barron and her right to receive moratory interest. We've not objected ever in the lower court proceeding. We don't object now. We do, however, object to the allocation of that interest against my client's interest in the estate. It was, of course, Mrs. Barron, Miriam Barron, who requested that the moratory interest, and she stated in her initial request, and I believe she still maintains today, she has done even in the briefs she filed in this court, that the delay upon which the moratory interest award was made was caused by the four sons, not by my clients. It was on that basis, it was on that request that the court ultimately entered the award. And what the court also went on to say was that she didn't see, Judge Stewart didn't see any way to allocate that interest other than pro rata. I'm not exactly sure why she said that, but there are other ways to allocate it other than pro rata if you determine who was at fault.
And why isn't your argument foreclosed by the fact that Judge Stewart made some findings that nobody in particular was at fault?
Well, I think if you look at the record as a whole, we did object to this, so I think we preserved this. I understand it's an abuse of discretion, and I understand, of course, that's a much more difficult standard to overcome. But I think if you look at the record as a whole, what ultimately happened is this battle, the delays started when Mrs. Barron petitioned to take her elective share. That's when the battle started. That's when the delays started. And those delays were not the cause of my clients. They were not caused by my clients. They were caused by the four sons. And I think if you're going to take the position that you're entitled, that she's entitled to moratory interest based upon delay, you have to look at who caused the delay. And I think you can, in fact, look at who caused the delay when you look at the record and you look at, in fact, it was the four sons who were the ones who were battling. And I'm not suggesting that they didn't have a right to battle. I think there's a statement in one of the briefs saying that's their right to do so. I'm not suggesting they have a right to do so, but if there's going to be a sanction that's going to be issued, it shouldn't be from my client's interest in the estate. It should be as to the four sons who, in fact, caused the delay.
Is there any indication in any of Judge Stewart's findings that she intended to impose a sanction as contrasted with merely making an equitable adjustment?
That's the intended to...
Impose a sanction as opposed to merely making an equitable adjustment.
Yes, there's at least one quote where she talks about the lack of cooperation of the four Bear Energy sons was an impediment to the administration of the estate's assets. And that's actually a quote from her court order. So I believe that the answer to your question is unqualified yes. I have a minute 23 seconds that I could reserve that to at least deal with some rebuttal on the corporate governance issue. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Westfall of the law firm of Hale Westfall, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of appellee Miriam Barron. I will focus my argument on why it was appropriate for the probate court to award Mrs. Barron an equitable adjustment on her elective share. The basic question presented this court is whether the probate court has equitable power to make the equitable adjustment under 1510.103. The probate court had such equitable power and did not abuse its discretion in exercising it. I would like to focus on just a couple of the many reasons why the probate court was correct. First, I will address why under Section 103 of the Probate Code, the probate court has equitable power in elective share cases. Second, I will address why Estate of Smith remains good law and was not overruled by the 1994 amendments. With respect to Section 103, I would like to start by reading the statute itself. It says, it's captioned Supplementary General Principles of Law Applicable. Quote, unless displaced by the particular provisions of this code, the principles of law and equity supplement its provisions. I think as a result of the colloquy that this court had with Mr. Brega and Myrie, I think it's quite clear based upon that colloquy and the briefs that they filed that they take a very absolutist position, that in elective share cases, there can never be any kind of adjustment, and again, in response to your questions, Judge Tomlin, any adjustment whatsoever, any exercise of equity, because as the three sons say in their brief, the General Assembly, quote, preempted the field. I respectfully submit to this court that that is an absurd position. There is always going to be, in a complex probate matter, particularly one involving many, many years of probate, of administration, for numerous circumstances where a probate court is going to have to, in the language of the statute, supplement the elective share provisions with an application of law, of the statute, an application of common law, and an application of equity in appropriate circumstances.
Are there any cases actually doing that? If that's going to happen so often, do we have any appellate cases where a court has actually done that?
The Estate of Smith does that.
I'm talking about after the statute was amended.
Let me go to my second point, because I think that it more directly answers your question. There's no case after the enactment of the statute. But let me talk about why Estate of Smith remains good law. They keep talking about the idea that there is that in fact what the court did in this particular situation on Judge Stewart, in fact was a, quote, fractional share. And that Estate of Smith, really you have to read into it, is a fractional share case because that was the scheme that existed at the time of before the 1994 amendments. That is simply a red herring and completely belied by any analysis of the case or application of general principles of statutory construction. Let's look, if you go to page 1074 of Estate of Smith, it is absolutely crystal clear. This court, the Court of Appeals, was not applying the fractional share provisions of the elective share statute in making the addition to the elective share The court was acting in its power in equity. It said, the language that was specifically used at page 1074 of the opinion, this court was observing that the trial court acting in probate was doing, made the adjustment, quote, based upon the equitable powers of the court.
Why isn't Smith distinguishable or of limited precedential value simply because there the parties did not dispute the threshold question of the court's equitable power, if any, but instead appear to have disputed only the accrual date for which it, from which interest would be calculated?
It is clear precedent for the exercise of equity in elective share context. I think it's even made more powerful and more strong by the following point, and this was something that we did not put in our briefs, but I think it's critically important. There is a general principle of statutory construction that the General Assembly is aware of the case law construing a statute when it amends the statute. As has been repeatedly talked about multiple times, there has not been an addition of an interest provision. And if there was an interest provision in the elective share statute, I do concede that that provision would control and that the probate court would have its equitable powers by the language of 103 explicitly displaced by a particular provision that would provide for interest. However, the state of the law in 1986, after a state of Smith, was that a probate court had equitable power to make an adjustment to the elective share in appropriate circumstances, exercising its equitable power. That was the state of the law. In 1994, in any subsequent amendments after that, that is the state of the law. The fact that the General Assembly has not amended it, that there is a very strong rule of statutory construction. I would cite a very recent Colorado Supreme Court case, People versus Lakey, 271 P3rd at 1111, specifically at page 1115. We presume the legislature is aware of existing case law precedent when it enacts or amends statutes. That is the provision. And so the state of the law in 1986, the state of the law in 1994, and I submit the state of the law today, is that a probate court has equitable power to make an adjustment in an appropriate circumstance.
Under your view of the court's equitable power, going back to Judge Taubman's question, could the judge have reduced the value of Mrs. Barron's interest if the oil market had tanked?
No.
Well, then, why does equity work only one way?
In that situation, and I've given a lot of thought to this, Judge Webb. In that situation, it would be absolutely lunacy for then, let's say, an analogous situation, let's say oil prices are going down. It would be lunacy then for the four sons to do what they did, which was immediately after Mrs. Barron filed her petition for distribution of elective share, immediately after essentially the probate, the Internal Revenue Service had concluded its audit. There'd been no delay. The Internal Revenue Service audited the numbers, looked at the 706 filing, and made a determination that, yes, that was the correct number. Shortly afterwards, Mrs. Barron files her distribution. As Judge Stewart's orders make very clear, she was prepared in a very uncontested two-hour hearing to distribute half of the estate. To answer your question, Judge Webb, it would be crazy then for the sons, suspecting that the oil prices are going to go down and the estate is going to go down, to delay like they did for a decade, which is clear from this record. Delayed like they did for a decade, if it was a situation where it was a declining asset. More importantly, Your Honor, the exercise of equity in this particular situation under Section 103 is not, we're not entitled to that. Mrs. Barron is not entitled to that. The court has it within its power to say yes or no. If Mrs. Barron would have acted inequitably, if she would have drug her fee, I suspect any probate court has it well within its power to say nope. We're going to do a distribution. I'm ordering it as of this specific date, and we're going to move on. And I'm fixing the numbers now. I'm not going to let you delay this anymore. And I'm certainly not going to give you any form of equitable adjustment. So that would deal with the situation I believe you're presenting, Mr. Webb, Judge Webb.
I'm not sure it does. You've explained why it's unlikely that there would be delay by the residuary beneficiaries if the state was subject to a specter of declining value, but that goes to the motivation of the parties. My question is, in the abstract, under your interpretation of the statute, could a probate court decrease the value of a surviving spouse's elective share because the estate assets had declined over time?
No.
Okay, why is it equitable that the adjustment can only be made upward but not downward?
Because equity rests within the sound discretion of the probate court, and it's the equitable portion supplementing the elective share statute is only going to be exercised when it is equitable to do so. That would be my answer, Judge Webb.
Thank you.
Now let's get to looking at one of the things that I think is very clear from the briefs and the arguments that have been made by the four sons regarding Section 103. We set forth in great detail in our brief, there's law to apply on how you look at 103 and when you determine whether or not particular provisions of the probate code have been displaced. We cite two cases, one of which I think is so powerful is to be an a fortiori situation where it leaves no doubt that the probate court in this particular situation had equitable power, and that is the Lunsford case. The Slayer statute that was at issue in the Lunsford case is a part of the probate code. If you go back and look at the Lunsford case, there's a situation where the insurance company made a distribution to the widow, only to find she subsequently admits to killing her husband. The children, who were the contingent beneficiaries, sued the insurance company, saying, "You gave the insurance proceeds to mom," and she admitted, after the fact, mind you, that she had in fact killed dad. You, the insurance company, are negligent, and therefore, we get to sue you. They went to trial court. The trial court rejected the fact that the Slayer statute was preempting the field. In fact, if you look at the dissent in Lunsford, that was exactly the point that was made by the dissent in Lunsford, that the Slayer statute preempted the field. Clearly, you have to look at the Slayer statute and say, an insurance company that looks at this is aware that there may be a question about whether or not there's some culpability on the part of the surviving spouse, goes ahead and makes the payment, but the insurance company's defense was clearly under the Slayer statute, we have a safe harbor. We're protected so long as the contingent beneficiaries don't give us notice. Once they're presented with a factual situation, the contingent beneficiaries don't provide notice, we pay, we are protected under the Slayer statute. Colorado Supreme Court says no, that's not, Court of Appeals said, you know what, you're absolutely right, reverse the trial court, and the Colorado Supreme Court reversed and said, unless the provisions of the, in this case, the common law, are specifically, explicitly, I think the words that the Lunsford Court used, explicitly displaced, we can shoehorn in on top of that the common law duty to act reasonably in distributing the insurance proceeds. I respectfully submit to this court that the insurance company in Lunsford had a far stronger argument on preemption of the field than we have in this particular situation. Here, Mrs. Barron files her petition for distribution of her equitable share right after the Internal Revenue Service conducts its audit and says the 706 amounts are correct. The Judge Stewart says, fine, it's $77 million is the estate, 30%, 50% of that is yours. We're going to move forward. I'm scheduling it for a 2-hour hearing in May, and we proceed to go on to a decade-long plus nuclear war in the administration of this estate. That is the record in this case. This court, I can make arguments about who's right and who's wrong and who's at fault and who's not and who wants it. The Judge Stewart speaks to this. She's describes all of the dispute that takes place over this decade-long odyssey, and explains her reasoning multiple times. Why, beginning in 1999, she rejects 512.102. She rejects the 904 interest on a device, but says, I retain my equitable powers under a state of Smith. Said that in 1999, maintained that position throughout the decade, and awarded an equitable adjustment that resulted in Mrs. Barron getting roughly 20% of the estate as it was essentially calculated in June 2010. There was equity that was done here. Judge Stewart clearly had the equitable power, and I respectfully ask this court to affirm in all respects. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Peter Forbes, and I represent the personal representative of this estate, Robert M. Goodyear, Jr. Your Honors, Mr. Goodyear has a dual role on this appeal. He was authorized by the probate court to represent the interests of the estate as a whole with respect to those matters impacting the estate as a whole, and he also has a role with respect to his compensation. There were some 15 matters that we briefed, and I'm prepared to address any of those that the court may have questions about. One matter I'm not prepared to address, and quite frankly we don't believe we can address consistent with the PR's fiduciary duty, is the moratorium interest issue. The state of Smith, I think, makes that clear. So every other issue in the case that was addressed, we addressed, and if you have any questions about those, I'm prepared to address those. But barring that, I want to address the issues that the PR is authorized to appear on that were raised by the various parties. There are three of those. The first is the compensation issue, the second is the corporate governance issue, and the third is the Moyer A and B lease issue that Mr. Sweetbaum addressed. Let me start with addressing the compensation issue. Your Honors, the applicable statute here is CRS 15-12-721. It's now been superseded, but that was a statute in effect, and that controls the analysis here. The question becomes, for this court, what is its role in reviewing the court's ruling on that issue? And I raise that for this reason. The court's role under the statute is pretty clear. As the first of the Painter cases said, the court's role is to look at the unique circumstances of the probate case, and if compensation becomes an issue, to look at, among others, the six factors identified in the statute and see whether the evidence presented to the court justifies the PR's request, compensation request. In other words, the court doesn't set compensation. The court's job is to see whether the evidence presented supports the compensation request. So what does that mean for this court? What that means, this court's job on review is twofold. One, did the court properly apply the law? And two, is there evidence to support the court's factual findings under the law? Here, there is no doubt about the fact that the court properly applied the law. How do we know that? Because if you look at her compensation order, which is 10 pages, single-spaced, very detailed, the first thing she does in that order is to set out what the court must do, and said what the court must do is review the factors set out in CRS 15-12-721 and apply those factors to this case to determine the reasonableness of the requested compensation. Did the court do that? It was beyond peradventure that the court did that. We have 10 pages of findings where the court does that.
Mr. Forbes, what's your response, though, to Mr. Myrie's argument that even though the court did that, that in fact it was relying on expert reports that stated a percentage value of the estate as the appropriate measure of compensation?
Sure. My first reaction to that is, and not to be facetious, incredulity. What Mr. Myrie is asking this court to do is to say, oh, the court didn't really apply the factors. The court didn't really do what she was doing. All she really did was to adopt some kind of percentage of the assets approach and dress it up with all these findings. Well, I don't know, and the reason I'm incredulous that he would make that argument, and he even says it in his brief, he says she purported to apply the factors. I haven't found any case that says a court of appeals job is to somehow look through the findings made by a trial court, look through a trial court's application of the law and say, that's not what the court was really doing. Quite frankly, it's a recipe for judicial chaos. I mean, how do we have review if the standard of review is, oh, a court's only purported to do that, you guys figure out what she's really doing and then make a ruling on that basis. So I think the whole argument is really, when you break down what he's really saying, it's not even a competent nature question for review. It's not
what is the relevance of the in this particular situation of the expert reports that appear to go to the question of percentage of value? Is there any relevance to this particular issue? And if so, why was this stuff even considered by the judge?
Yes, okay. And here's what the relevance is. There are six factors identified in the statute that the court should consider, and then it says they're not specific, that you can consider other factors unique to the case. Two of those factors are the fee customarily charged in the locality for similar circumstances and the amount involved in the results obtained. Now, in this case, what the expert did, and this is important, and it's we made this absolutely clear in the testimony if you read the transcript, and it's absolutely clear in the expert's report. The expert did not say this is how much compensation Mr. Goodyear should get. He did not say he should get compensation based on a percentage of assets. What he said was, in the locality, let's look at what is charged for the services provided by Mr. Goodyear. All right, and Mr. Goodyear provided two services, and actually this is a point we agree with our opponents on. Both services were provided in his role as personal representative. One was managing these ongoing businesses. The other was managing and handling the estate assets, as it were, the estate process. What the expert's report said is that in the locality, the Denver market, if they had to go out and buy these estate management services, if they had to go out and get them, the way that people charge for that is on a percentage basis. Colorado National Bank, U.S. Bank, which is a successor trustee, etc. Then he said the way you charge for business management services is salary, bonus, all those other things. Then he said if you went out and tried to replace these services in the market, this is how much you would have to pay based on considering both those inputs. All right. That was one of the statutory factors, the fee customary charge in the locality. The court did not base her opinion, and this is kind of a canard that's in the reply brief when they said the court awarded compensation based on the expert opinion. It didn't. The amounts in the expert opinion are not what the court awarded. That's just not true. What the court said in her opinion about the expert report is that she used it specifically in her consideration of item 3, the fee customarily charged in the locality for similar services. She referenced the report not as something that was determining for her what these estate management services would require. She used it because she said it provided a factual basis and evidence that the additional compensation requested represents the cost of a replacement PR. And the court, and she said it provides some factual basis for this PR to determine how the services he provided are customarily charged in this locality. And I think it's important also for this court to keep in mind that despite their contention that the first of the Painter cases somehow made any consideration of percentage fees anathema, all Painter says, the first Painter case says, is that we're changing the statute. We're no longer going to give, basically, we're going to disregard what you did. You come in, you show us you had an estate of $5 million, you get 3% on that. You had an estate of $10 million, you had 2% of that. No matter how simple it was, no matter how much work you did, no matter anything. It said, we're taking that off the table. That's not the way it works anymore. You look at the unique nature of the case. Painter did not say that when you're looking at the factor, the fee customarily charged in the locality, it did not say that you have to ignore the fact that institutional fiduciaries would have charged a percentage fee for this service. And in fact, this point I'm making, that Painter doesn't bar any particular, certainly doesn't bar consideration of analogous services, regardless of how they're priced. There's a case called In Re Santorelli, which actually implies that she could have actually used a percentage test as long as she went through and said, well, given the amount involved, given the effort, given all of this, in that case, you can possibly a percentage fee approach would have been appropriate. In that Santorelli case is 74P3rd 523, and it's referring to a case where the it's referring to a trial court decision that says, which referenced a simple percentage of the estate's assets, and this is a key quote, which is improper absent further justification. So it's really a sham argument anyway, because she didn't award it based on a percentage of the estate. She awarded it based on going through the factors and saying, based on these factors, it's reasonable. Now, there's some other canards in their argument, too, that if you review the record, you can see. There was no expert opinion by any of the parties opposing compensation that this was unreasonable. There was no expert opinion saying that the principal increase in value was simply due to the price of oil going up, the rising tide floats all boats theory. In fact, the expert opinion was to the contrary. The only expert opinion on that was that of the expert we presented, who compared the performance of Mr. Goodyear managing these assets to standard industry benchmarks. And he showed that Mr. Goodyear's performance far outperformed those benchmarks. So the court knew all that. The court took that into account. This rising tide argument, if you look at the transcript, was made by Mr. Barron. It was rejected by the court. So for them to come in and say that a patent report, which if you look at that, you'll see he doesn't attribute the increase in assets. He doesn't say it was due to a rising tide either. He just says that there was an increase in the value of the assets. He doesn't attribute it to the rise in the price of oil. That's not true either. So the court did the right thing. She applied the law right. She made findings. They don't object to the findings. They can't object to the law because she said she was applying the right law, and she did apply the right law. And this whole idea that you can come in and say that a court purported to do something in reverse on that basis is just not appropriate, and it's really not even a cognizable argument on appeal. Let me talk briefly now about the corporate governance issue. I want to address a question that was raised. Was there any expert testimony that these voting rights would be different? No. There's no testimony that this would affect value. And Mr. Myrie also said, under the will, everybody was entitled to 1/7 of these entities. That also is incorrect. The will doesn't entitle anybody to anything, any specific asset, other than $1 million devise. Each of the kids were entitled to $1 million. That's the only specific devise. The rest of the property was not specifically devised. And why is that important? That's important because that means they had no right, title, interest, or claim to Berenergy, or there's another entity that the estate owns called Matsliok, another entity called Scheftel. They had no right to stock in any of those entities.
They did have a right to share, overall to share on a 1/7 basis equally.
Equal value. And the will actually says you can distribute different shares as long as they have equal value.
Did the plan of distribution allocate any compensation to the four brothers to reflect the fact that the Class A shares had fewer or lesser voting rights than the Class B shares? Was there a specific compensatory transfer?
There was none because there's no evidence. We had no evidence. We could find no case law evidence that creating a class voting structure that equalizes the power of two competing groups affects the value, the economic value of the interest distributed.
That goes to Judge Webb's earlier question, and that is whether there was ever any expert testimony on that issue. And I take it the answer from everybody is no.
There was. They were opposing it, claiming it created disequal value. It was their burden to present that testimony. They did not present it.
Why is it their burden rather than the PR's?
Because they're the ones that are contesting that. They're the ones that are asserting the affirmative that because we changed the voting rights, that there's a decrease in value.
Wasn't it before the court on the PR's essentially request that this is how the estate should be distributed, and weren't you implicitly saying the values were equal?
Well, we did argue that what happened is we made our plan. Yes, we implicitly argued that the values were equal. They objected. They were given 60 days to file their objections, and they were given a lengthy time to do discovery and submit expert reports. They did none of that. So I think my view is it's their burden. They didn't meet their burden, and there's no case law to even support the proposition that they're advancing. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Parties' times are exhausted except as follows. Mr. Myrie has a minute and 15 seconds, and Mr. Sweetbaum has a minute and 23 seconds.
Thank you. I used my time wisely. Mr. Forbes said there was no indication that the appreciation of the estate was due to a rise in oil, that Mr. Patton didn't attribute to that. That's just not the case. What Mr. Patton said in his report is, given the estate's substantial investment in oil and gas properties, the asset appreciation appears to be primarily, if not entirely, the result of the dramatic rise in the price of a barrel of oil during that period. He specifically notes about a $70 increase. So that is actually there in the record. On the moratory interest issue, essentially what Marion Barron's argument is that there is equitable power for the probate court to change how Section 1511.201 defines the elective share amount. And I don't know of any equitable power that exists, whether in a probate court or anywhere, that would allow an amendment to the statute at the whim of a probate court exercising equity. That is all that her order does. It changed what the way the statute worked and what the elective share amount would be. That is beyond the equitable power of the court. Thank you.
I'll try to use my time just as wisely. I'll deal solely with the corporate governance issue. As I think is clear, each of the seven children got stock in Bear Energy. The stock was divided equally, each worth 1/7 of the interest in Bear Energy. After 14 years of contentious litigation, there is one thing I think that is very clear. There are two camps of the family. There are the four sons, and there are my clients, which consist of three children. Unless something was done with respect to how these interests would be divided, one of those camps was going to be relegated to a minority status. And I think what the PR did in this case was, although a bit unique in terms of the coin flip aspect of it, I think in terms of allocating A shares to one and B shares to another so that each could elect one director, and then those two directors would in turn decide or elect on a third director, was a perfectly reasonable way of avoiding the relegation of one camp to a minority status. Certainly was not an abuse of discretion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Appreciate the arguments of both counsel. We particularly appreciate counsel's cooperation with the time limits we set forth in a fairly complex circumstance. The arguments were helpful. We will issue a written opinion in due course. This case stands submitted. Since this exhausts our morning docket, the bailiff may announce a recess.